PD Pods present the CoronaCast. Welcome back to the CoronaCast, hosted by PD Pods and myself, Pranay Budev. For those regular listeners, I apologize for the two-week hiatus that we've had at this time, but I felt it was really important we brought to you topics that were relevant to the ongoing pandemic instead of just putting content out there that may not be beneficial to the listeners. Saying that, as we continue to navigate the global pandemic, there is one group of patients who are particularly at risk, and that is children. Everyone's facing multiple new stresses, including physical, psychological health risks, school and business closures, family confinement, isolation, economic vulnerability. But we must remember that children are especially vulnerable and directly impacted by the reduced access to essential services like health, school and social services. And it's great that we could invite Miss Emily Baird, who's a consultant pediatric orthopedic surgeon from the Royal Hospital for Sick Children in Edinburgh, and who sits on the education committee of BISCOS, having recently hosted the Current Concepts course last November. She wrote a fantastic article in the Transient Journal of Trauma, Orthopedics and Coronavirus by the BOA on non-accidental injury in children at the time of COVID. And I thought it was perfect to sit down and speak to her about this. Emily, thank you so much for joining me.
Well, thank you very much for the invite. I've been a fan of the CoronaCast and the PDPod podcast. So thank you for having me on. And I think it's just such a crucial message to get out there that although children are not liable to get COVID and the physical effects from that, there is collateral damage happening behind closed doors, and really non-accidental injury or child abuse is thought to be a silent pandemic anyway, and add that to the global pandemic, there really is a perfect storm for abuse happening. And we've seen that. There's been cases reported in Texas where there's been, in a single day, there was two deaths secondary to child abuse and six serious cases within that week. So that's at the extreme, and that's horrific to hear about that. But what I think is happening more, speaking to my colleagues across the UK, is that actually there's underreporting of child abuse. So it's down by, you know, two-thirds, three-quarters, those sorts of figures. And that's not that it's not happening. It is happening. It's happening more. We just don't know about it. Those doors are firmly closed, and you know, sadly, there's a whole host of factors that is leading it to become more prevalent at this time. As you mentioned, you know, social isolation, it has been enforced on us all, and it's hard going. You know, even in stable, nurturing families, there is a lot of stress at the moment from, you know, from the pandemic, from the financial fallout from that. You know, just focusing on the financial aspect, there's a paper looking at head trauma during the last financial recession, and that went up hugely. So even if you just think about that alone, then we're in for stormy weather. And I think
I was shocked to hear that, you know, there's over 50,000 deaths due to child abuse around the world annually. I mean, that's a really scary number, and, you know, huge volume. And, you know, obviously, you know, this is mostly happening all around the world, and I'm sure in a lot of low-income countries. But again, it's very difficult to sort of assess that at this standpoint, because, as we said, these are complex injuries. And actually, most you know, children who undergo some degree of physical abuse, not, you know, only about a third of them are reported to have a fracture. And that's really scary, because, you know, as orthopedic surgeons, we're trained to be very vigilant about a non-accidental injury. You know, the children that present with the metaphyseal corner fractures, the children who are below walking age, who get femur fractures, these are the ones that we typically see and always talk about, especially in the exam setting. But they are a complex spectrum of injuries. And so, you know, what are we findings happening at the moment?
So we're finding that they are just not presenting as frequently, or if they are presenting, there's even more delays to the normal, you know, the worrying feature in the history that there's a delay to the presentation. We're seeing that even more so now, and having to deal with injuries a bit further down the line. So that has, you know, a surgical challenge, but kind of more importantly, there's this huge effect on the child. And as you say, I think we just need to be hypervigilant, not only to child abuse, but intimate partner abuse as well. I mean, the PRAISE studies showed that in fracture clinics, 1 in 6 females had experienced domestic violence. So that is going to rocket up at the moment as well. So I think when we're seeing children at the moment, we should be actively ruling out child abuse, being really scrutinising of the mechanism of injury. Just don't put it down to the trampoline, which is obviously, modus operandi number one at the moment. But whether that's in ED or whether that's in fracture clinic, it has to be the forefront of your mind. And it's a stressful time for us as healthcare professionals, and we're being redeployed to different areas, and the normal processes, you know, you hope are being upheld, but it's stressful, and NAI, non-accidental injury, can be subtle. And you really don't want to be the one that misses it. And there are groups, I think, that you have to be particularly aware of. And one of the main ones is age. So the younger they are, the more likely the injury is due to a non-accidental or child abuse cause. So particularly femur fractures, as you say, if they can't cruise around the furniture, they can't bruise. So really any femoral fracture and under age of 1, and there was a good paper from Piers Mitchell looking at the age cutoffs, and under age of 12 months for femoral shaft fracture, under the age of 2 for a humeral shaft fracture, are particular ones you should be worried about. But any fracture or any injury, in fact, could be non-accidental injury. And, you know, you mentioned the coronary fracture, the pathognomic, you know, twisting rotational force around, you know, the immature skeleton does sometimes give that little corner sign, and we get very focused on looking for that, but actually any fracture could represent abuse.
Yeah, and you know, obviously when we think about this time, obviously social isolation and family confinement is certainly a new test of parents. Both of us have young children, and even though I'm lucky enough to have my children in school Monday to Friday, you know, it is a true test for both me and my wife on the weekends in those limited hours we spend with them, controlling them. And obviously, it's because there is a degree of no respite. You know, a lot of people are having to work from home, but be expected by the education system to homeschool their children. You know, it's very difficult to do both at the same time. There's a huge amount of demand, especially with younger children. And the other one are those people who live in apartments and condos who don't have outdoor space. Again, you know, children tend to burn off a lot of their energy, and you can park them outside in the garden. They tend to be pretty happy when we had some good weather a couple of weeks back. But not having any outdoor space must be a huge problem for this as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, initially they were saying that COVID was a leveler and there was no differences in social class, but I think there absolutely is, not how people are become infected necessarily, but more the effects of confinement. You know, all very well if you have a big house and big garden, but that is not the majority of families in the UK. Multiple children all in a small space without outdoor space. And really, you know, the parents are stressed. They might be trying to work from home on top of looking after the children. And, you know, it's a bit of a melting pot. And, you know, it's a very stressful environment. And often, you know, mental health is suffering. The parents or the carers, they might be dealing with grief, potentially from a loss of someone in the family from COVID, loss of employment, substance abuse. And they might not be able to access healthcare as readily either. So, you know, the more I looked into this when I was writing the article for the BOA, for the JTO, the more worried and scared I got, and the more passionate I felt that the message needed to go out there. So I've been tweeting a lot about it. There's a little video that can be shared. And I've been speaking to my colleagues in pediatrics and social work, and, you know, really trying to get the message out there.
Yeah, and we'll attach, you know, the video and the article into the show notes of this episode. You said at the beginning, obviously, that the numbers reported right now are down. Personally, sort of having been redeployed to sort of the A&E department for pediatrics, I am noticing that people are presenting 2 to 3 days later following the injury. Normally, your child has an injury, you take them straight to the accident emergency department. I am finding that a lot of parents are sort of waiting to see if it improves and then comes back. But obviously, we do have to, as we mentioned before, be a little more vigilant about that and document that clearly, that there was that delay to presentation, even though it may seem reasonable in this current time that people want to reduce the footfall and not present to hospitals unless necessary. But the other thing you mentioned was a lot of this is happening behind closed doors and is not being reported. What, having spoken to some of your colleagues, especially in the pediatric and social work section, what's being done about that to ensure that those children, especially those children who are documented on specific systems that being at risk, are being looked after well?
Sure. So 10%, there's a recent Scottish government report, and 10% of children, so between 0 and 17, have a multi-agency plan in place. So basically children that need extra support. So that's a huge number out there. So how do you support, 10% plus of the children's population? And that report went into numerous different strategies involving community hubs, getting some of these kids actually into school, even, when most of the schools are closed, and involving the third sector and really ramping up sort of telephone and online support. But it's a real challenge. But reports like that have multiple different groups looking into it. It really is on people's radar. It's just really challenging to access the children that probably need it most.
And obviously, with schools being closed, this also causes issues, not only from an education side, but also from children who don't have access to, food and meals. I'm sure that must put a huge amount of stress on there as well. What have you heard about how that's sort of been looked after? Have you heard anything? Because a lot of these families, there'll be a crossover, I'm sure.
Yeah, there absolutely is. And the kids that receive free meals are on the radar and prioritised. So as you say, there's crossover, and a lot of it is due to deprivation. So those vulnerable children need more support.
And I was actually supposed to have a neuromuscular clinic just gone this Friday. And obviously, all of these children have asked to be shielded for a minimum of 12 weeks. I'm sure that's going to be stretched. But I did think that, a lot of these children are likely to be children at risk. Their parents are all very loving full-time carers, but, that respite that they may have to go out to the shops or even to meet a friend for coffee, that has gone now. So I utilized that opportunity to call all of my patients as I was going to almost like a telephone clinic to sort of prioritize how quick I needed to see them afterwards. But I felt it was quite a unique opportunity to check on the parents at the same time and say, how are you getting on? Are you being supported? And if not, is there someone we can get you in contact with? How, as pediatric orthopedic surgeons who only really look after a specific aspect of this patient's care, what can we do to help alleviate this sort of problem?
Well, I think you're setting a great example there. And what you're demonstrating is checking in with others and just that emotional contact that is lacking. And that doesn't need to be professionally. That can be in your personal lives as well, your neighbor's children. It really is that nurturing approach that is the antidote to the trauma that comes with child abuse. So I think you're doing a great thing there. And unfortunately, as well as the respite for kids with additional needs being lost, those kids anyway are at higher risk. So I think identifying children within your patient population that may be at more risk and contacting them is an excellent idea.
Obviously, the healthcare system is, seriously under stress right now. And we want to sort of maintain the standards of care that we normally have. But again, we have to look at our current situation. If we typically had a child who we were suspicious of being subjected to non-accident injury, they would be admitted, seen by a multidisciplinary team of the pediatricians, the orthopedic surgeon, and they would typically also have a skeletal survey or a head CT. I've only had one patient so far that we thought may be a victim of this, and you know, we undertook this. But is that still being practiced around the country as normal, or have a lot of centres sort of adjusted the way they monitor this? And what has been the new normal role of the social worker in this situation?
Well, I can certainly comment from the orthopaedic standpoint that NAI is still absolutely top priority. I helped Fergal Monsell and Bristol to write guidelines for the BOA, really dealing with what should be prioritised at this time. And NAI is right up there. So absolutely admit to a place of safety, involve your local child protection team. And, you know, their discharge may actually be delayed because of the situation, and you know, they might not be able to discharge to emergency foster placement, or you know, the usual routes. It might well all be delayed, but the message is admit them.
And yeah, and you know, obviously involve the local safeguarding team. And actually, a lot of these people at the moment tend to have a little more time on their hands compared to normal. Hopefully they're using it wisely and checking in on some of their cases. But, you know, we found that we were able to get quite a rapid investigation done, even within a couple of hours, which would have normally taken probably a day or two just because of the normal stresses on our services. Obviously, mental health in children at the end of this is going to be a big problem, as I feel it's going to be amongst the whole population. There is going to be a degree of fear and all this. Do you think... this is, of course, just asking your opinion, that this mental health is going to cause problems in the future with regards to non-accidental injury or even any problematic psychological effects?
You know, that's so interesting, that, and I don't know the answer to it. I think it depends how quickly lockdown is resolved and whether we have to go, you know, continual cycles of it. I think majority of children are fairly robust psychologically. I mean, one of the main determinants is how robust psychologically their parents are. So I think look to see what effect there is on the economy and you know, the well-being of parents. And I think you can then predict what will happen with children. But I think we need to have it on our radar and be more vigilant for a long, long time.
Yeah, thank you. And I think we'll sort of wrap up the non-accidental injury side there. It's obviously quite depressing hearing about it.
Yeah, I know, I'm sorry.
The role of us as clinicians is to, as we said over and over, is to have a high index of suspicion, maintain our typical standards, and appreciate that any fracture at this time can represent abuse. And delayed presentations, all these red flags we should be looking at with even more scrutiny than normal. And for those parents who are listening, obviously there's a huge issue with regards to online safety of children. Obviously a lot of children are being taught over the web right now and through different applications, and we do tend to give them the iPad and say, here, leave us alone for half an hour. But online safety is another very important thing to consider in general. Let's move on to something else. How have you been affected up in Scotland? Obviously, you've had smaller numbers than NHS England have reported. How has it affected you guys in Edinburgh and at the Royal Hospital for Sick Children?
So, as you say, you know, we've not had a huge surge. It's always been fairly manageable, and we had a slight delay to be able to plan. In Edinburgh, for the adult service, they have been redeployed to minor injuries, and they have spent a week, has a sort of 3-week rolling rota, so kind of covering inpatients, covering outpatients, and at home. And you know, the prediction that a lot of people will be unwell from a staffing point of view, which hasn't really transpired, thankfully. But a little opportunity arrived from that. So Tim White, who's one of the trauma surgeons, looked at the rota and saw that week off, as it were, as an opportunity. And so with Tim and one of the trainees, Tom Howard, we set up VOTE, which stands for Virtual Orthopaedic Trainee Education. So we're actually into week six of that program. So really taking a negative of the COVID situation and turning it into a positive, and running twice daily teaching episodes over Zoom. So that has been going down very well. I'm very grateful to all the faculty, all the consultants that have been teaching, and all the trainees that really grasped that one. So I suppose that's just a little educational spin on how things are going. We really haven't been too overwhelmed with COVID cases, and we haven't been treating things necessarily in our normal fashion. We have been absolutely prepared to scale it all down. And I know in the adult side of things, they've still been treating neck and femur fractures as they would normally, and they're still coming in at absolute constant rates. But a lot of the other trauma has really decreased in its presentation, and they are managing a lot more conservatively. And I think we're all, you know, at this stage of the game, we've all flexed, we've all pivoted, we've all adapted, we've used, you know, guidelines from the BOA and the BISCOS to, you know, adapt what we're doing locally and find what's working for us. And now there's just challenges looking ahead.
And as you know, I've been quite interested, and I've been deployed to the minor injuries unit and been keeping a log of all the mechanisms, which we will have another episode about hopefully in the next couple of weeks. But tell me, what have you found in your, are you still seeing the same number of children sustaining fractures? We've had about a 20% drop, but as you've probably heard, we've had a 500% increase in trampoline injuries.
Yes, the trampoline. As well as, you know, knowing about that from a professional angle, I'm also on social media as a mother, and oh my goodness, there has been some crazy amount of panic buying of trampolines, and I've just seen them popping up everywhere. And I know you're going to focus that on that in a different podcast. But no, we haven't seen a great deal, and that makes me a bit worried that there are injuries there that haven't come to light, and that we will be dealing with the fallout of that, whether it's, you know, deformity that needs corrected at a later date, hopefully not child abuse, but that's potential. And also what is going to happen when lockdown is relieved and sort of second wave, and how we're going to cope with that. It's another concern.
And finally, obviously you organised a fantastic current concepts course for BISCOS last year in November. And I really feel that this period has, as you mentioned, allowed a lot of people to pivot to different methods of training and teaching. And it sounds like, I mean, twice daily teaching is phenomenal. I haven't heard of any other region in the country. And I've spoken to a lot of them about doing twice daily teaching. Obviously, there's a lot of webinars going on right now. There's Author Hub down in London that's doing a weekly one. Eastern England are doing regular ones. The Northern DD, I mean, lots of people, but twice daily really is something special. Obviously, having organized something like that and knowing that huge conferences around the world in our field, like POSNA, are moving to do this sort of online virtual conference, what do you think, in your opinion, is potentially the role of future meetings like BISCOS, like the current concepts course? Obviously, we'll definitely miss the social aspect and the Kaylee dancing.
Every conference should have a Kaylee, but that's obviously personal opinion, slightly biased. No, it's a good question. Obviously, a lot of societies, their hand is forced at the moment, like POSNA, to become an online entity. And the same in Edinburgh. So every year we have a big trauma conference, international trauma symposium, and instructional course. And it's also gone fully online. You know, it's got live case-based discussions, meet the expert, cadaveric demonstrations, all online. You know, and that is the extreme, if you like, from the current concept that I hosted, which was all on-site, you know, face-to-face, no lasting kind of information out there on the web. So I think there's going to be a bit of a hybrid between the two. I don't think there is any substitute for meeting face-to-face. I think the discussion that happens at coffee breaks, you know, that becomes research collaborations, that become, you know, it snowballs. And I would find it hard to see how that could be replicated virtually. So I would like to see that continue, as well as obviously the social elements as well. So I think there is going to be a face-to-face educational events going forwards, but I think we'll all be a bit more savvy about also having online, you know, live content for people to participate in, and particularly recorded information out there. I think Osna do very well. You know, their IPOS lectures that you can view are excellent, and I think we should be looking to do something similar. And I think we're all getting more savvy at using Zoom, so there's no excuse.
Yeah, I feel we're going to be all zoomed out by the end of this.
Yeah.
Well, look, Emily, I really want to thank you for taking your time on the weekend to talk to me about this. I think we've really driven home the important point about how non-accident injuries likely to be on the rise at this time may not be presenting. And that may lead us to challenges having to manage it at a later date. Obviously, highlighting the groups at risk, especially everyone's in social isolation, but especially those children with extra needs, those who parents are either having to work from home or in financial economic problems, those who potentially don't have an outdoor space, and those households with multiple children, or even recently born children with mothers who may be suffering from postnatal depression and psychosis and not getting the appropriate review. I'm really impressed by sort of what you've continued to say about how we can manage it going forward. We'll put some links in the show notes of this, and good luck with the rest of all the VOTES teaching program you're doing.
Thank you very much, and thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure.
And ladies and gentlemen, that's the end of this episode of the CoronaCast. I hope you'll join us next week for another episode where we hope to be talking about how we are going to get out of this and get back to our normal service with Mr. Fergal Motsu. We look forward to seeing you then. Take care.